Good evening, folks. Thank you for coming in out of the bright sunshine. I know it was difficult to share some time with us here in this space and to help us meditate on the significance of where social justice and the capturing of moments within social justice movements through the lens of a camera, how significant that is, particularly in an era where we perhaps take for granted that all of us have high definition cameras right at our hips at every given moment, and how that conversation continues further into the technological era. And I'm tickled to have Devin here because I'm a big fan of his work and think that what photographers from the era of my great uncle really offered in the midst of the civil rights movement have translated in heart and spirit so much to the work of what Devin Allen and his contemporaries are capturing for you now. So we're going to start with just a few images to help you get to know my uncle posthumously. But I like this one because he was not necessarily a modest man, but it was wonderful to find these. When I curated the original exhibit, Photographic Memory, last June here at Slott, I hadn't found these images again. I just uncovered them about 2 months ago. So it's nice to be able to show them to people. And so, of course, with the big bulb camera and with the tallest of these awards that are on the table is from the Capitol Press Club. And just kind of capturing this moment of him clearly being proud, these images were taken by the American Newspaper Magazine Publishers Association. Just capturing his moment, a self-taught photographer like Devin, so we're going to talk about that a little bit, who was told, little short black guy, why is this something that you even aspire to? Nobody's going to let you in anywhere to get significant pictures. You know, stay behind your good government job desk and let that be it. And he decided, after hearing that one too many times, that he was going to quit that good government job and go out and be a photographer full time. So to receive the accolades was a big deal to him. And this notion of, you know, like I said, we have these high definition cameras right at our hips these days, but what it took for a 5'3 guy to go running around in spaces where he wasn't particularly welcome with that big camera and sort of elbow his way into place in order to capture some of the images that he ended up capturing is, the pride of being successful. That to me is written all over his face in these images. Slightly older, but what I wanted to show in this is the idea of the brotherhood of photographers. As you will see, for those of you who stick around and check out the permanent installation in the vault, there is an image of a telegram that was sent by C. Sumner Stone, who was then the editor of the Washington Afro-American newspaper, thanking President Kennedy for intervening on behalf of my uncle to say that in 1957, at that seminal moment when our country was on the verge of really digging into what we now know as the civil rights movement, that for there not to be any black photographers among the pool of White House news photographers was a statement that President Kennedy likely did not want to continue under his leadership. And so, with a few healthily placed phone calls and letters, my uncle was the first one to receive those official credentials. And so, you know, going from being the only 5'3" little guy elbowing his way into place into having a community of photographers that were working the same beat, I think is so significant. And so this photo helps to capture some of that. This notion of what stories you tell with the camera, I think is also really important because you get to go to places when you have the credentials, when you have the reputation that other people don't get to go. I like the snazzy socks too in this photo. But this is, you probably can't see, this is a Metro PD helicopter. So he was going up with members of DC's police department. I'm not sure what he was going to shoot, but this notion of an elder gentleman still really being in the field and making the relationships that allowed him access to tell these stories in the various places where he sold his photos is just something that I think more people should see and understand. And Devin and I are going to talk a little bit about that notion of being on the ground. As many of you may recognize, you know, my uncle wasn't necessarily the recognized face like his counterpart to his right, LaRon Bennett, but they both were staff photographers for Johnson Publications, my uncle for 32 years. And so in this picture, this is the 40th annual award ceremony at the National Press Club in DC, 84. See, when it's blown up that big on the wall, I could actually see it. And so my uncle was receiving the one for local, exceptional, an outstanding performance in the Washington metro area, and Mr. Bennett was receiving the one for national. And so as colleagues, it's nice to have this image of them together sharing in a moment. And then just one final headshot of my uncle, and you can't see from here, but that's the White House press credential pin that he has on his lapel. And so he's the reason I'm here to lead this conversation, but we want to now begin to have some conversation about how my uncle leads to you, Devin, and to the next generation of people who are capturing these images. And I just saw a screening of Avengers Endgame yesterday.
I didn't see it yet. Don't spoil it for me.
No. I would never do that, but I'm interested in, and I think the folks who are here in our audience are interested in your origin story.
My origin story. Is this mic on? Oh, it is on. I can hear it now.
Yeah.
Well, I'm Devin Allen, Baltimore, born and raised photographer, self-taught. Never thought that I would ever be a photographer. It was never in the game plan to be an artist at all. For me, growing up in Baltimore, I had a very, you know, I had a normal childhood. Like, I had a real good family system, you know, raised by my grandmother, my mom, my stepdad. And life really changed for me at the age of 16 when one of my friends was murdered over a dice game. And that kind of like shook my world up. And that's when I really realized like how cruel the world is. Yeah. And then from there, I kind of went down like a dark path. So I followed the path of a lot of people in my community. I started selling drugs. You know, a lot of my friends were just getting murdered. It became like second nature, you know, like, and it's still a part of my life, gun violence. You know, like I just lost 2 friends this year. I buried 6 last year. You know, it's just a part of my life. It's something that even now that I'm a successful artist, I just can't get away from.
Yeah.
But what really prompted me to change my life is I had a daughter at a very young age, at 19, and my dad was in and out of my life. I just wanted to be like an amazing dad. And I didn't just want to be like a regular dad, like, oh, you know, my dad, I love him because he takes care of me. I want to be like, my dad is fucking awesome. You know, like, I want her to like literally say that, you know, in front of somebody. Like, my dad, that's the only time you can drop the F-bomb. But, you know, and then, you know, I went to my mom and I said, hey, you know, I don't want to be in the streets anymore, you know, and she helped me get a job at her job working in corporate America, you know, but I was like, this cannot be life. I felt like I was dying in a small cubicle, like just, Devin, cut this check, Devin, post this check, Devin, run this down to the mailroom. And I'm just like, this cannot be the rest of my life. And then, you know, I struggled with it because, like, I would come outside and, like, my friends would have the new BMWs, mm-hmm. ride around with Mercedes-Benz, they taking trips all over the place because, you know, they in the streets, they make a lot of money. And I just was like, I don't want to go back there, you know, like for once in my life, I didn't have to constantly look over my shoulder.
Yeah.
And then I had this good friend, we were total opposites. Like he was like the straight A student, you know, star athlete. And I was like the kid that could have been a straight A student, never applied himself, rarely came to class, athlete, but could never stay on the team. We were like, you know, we were like day and night, but we were really good friends, you know, he was like, when he was in high school, he was training to go to Iraq, which all of us thought was crazy at the time. Like, why you want to go to Iraq, bro? You're tripping, you know? But he ended up going. When he came back, he was into poetry, and he introduced me to poetry. Mm-hmm. And at the time in the city, I know a lot of people in the city because I have a very big family, and then I'm really known in the city. And he said he wanted me to do this poetry night with him. And I was just like, bro, like, we don't know anything about poetry. Like, no one's going to come. Nobody in the hood know anything about poetry. Nobody's going to come. And nobody came. And then eventually, he was like, no, give it time. It's something different. So eventually, it picked up. You know, we started seeing, we did it every other Tuesday. It was like 200 people.
Yeah.
You know, and it got to the point, we were splitting the money down the middle. And he was just like, look, we splitting the money down the middle, but you're not doing nothing but, like, chilling. And I'm like, he's like, you need to write a poem or something. So I wrote my first poem, performed it, which was totally left field of who I was, you know, because I had a certain reputation. So nobody took me seriously. Everybody laughed when I performed. And, you know, but I liked it, but I just, it wasn't for me. Yeah. And I was like, well, I'm going to make t-shirts. And I had this young lady take pictures, and then we put them on t-shirts, and we would sell them at the poetry night. But I never knew how long, like, photography, the process of it was. I thought it was just, like, take the picture, email it. That's it. I didn't know about editing, processing. I didn't know any of that. So I was just like, I'm going to do it myself. And my homie was like, you don't know anything about photography. I was like, you just click the button. Like, it's not that difficult. So I started taking the pictures myself on my friend's camera. And I was like, I actually like this. And I like the human interaction where you put the lens on people. My friends are totally different.
Yeah.
And then I was like, I think I want to be a photographer. So I started YouTubing. And I was like, you know, and then I'm like, let me see if there's any famous black photographers, because I didn't know any photographers. I didn't even know it was a thing. It was never introduced to me. And I remember I just found Gordon Parks, like, on Google, and I was like, he had a slick back head, the pipe, and I was like, I want to be like this guy. So I called my grandma. I was like, I'm going to be a photographer. I'm about to go to Best Buy and get my camera. And she was like, go ahead, baby. So I went down there. Nobody told me how expensive it was. So I called my grandmother back, was like, you got Best Buy credit card? Can I borrow it? And of course, I'm the oldest grandchild, so
yeah.
I get what I need. So, and I got my first camera in 2013, and I've just been chasing this dream ever since.
Yeah, yeah. And with that, the idea of support, that you didn't know what you were reaching for, but your grandmother loved you.
Yes.
And said, well, if it's a budding passion, let's get him a camera and see what happens. And look what has happened.
A lot.
But also, you know, we can't overlook the idea that you getting in touch with your gift was also born of seeing so much tragedy.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's important for us to put, particularly because you are born, raised, still live in, are dedicated to Baltimore. For us, put Freddie Gray and everything that you captured in association with the feelings of Baltimore around this young man's death in context for us, because that really is what propelled you, the jump between amateur photographer to professional.
Yeah. Can we run some of the, if I hit this with
yes.
A, oh. So Freddie Gray, it's funny because me and Freddie Gray actually had mutual friends. Baltimore's one of those cities where, like, you know, it take you like 25 to 30 minutes to get everywhere, depending on traffic. So I'm from West Baltimore, literally not even 10 minutes up the street from where everything took place. So the thing is with Baltimore, it's a very, I feel like I've been, there's no other city like it. I think Philadelphia is probably the closest thing to it. And so coming up, like, I didn't know Freddie personally, but I know a lot of his friends. A lot of us come up the same ways. Like, you know, me, it was lucky enough that my mom was able to, like, move me around enough and get me out of a situation, because if she didn't, I probably would have been deeper into it.
Yeah.
Whereas though a lot of my peers are born into it. And a lot of people understand that a lot of my friends were dropping out in middle school, you know, because they were raising their little brothers and sisters. I have homeboys that are like, I'm 16, you know, we thinking about like trying to go to prom and girls. So one of my friends was a cold-blooded murderer by the age of 16. Murdered three people, you know, and you know, I always use this thing where it's like Baltimore is like, it's like a jungle. Like, it really is, because people are really starving. And when you really think about, you take two tigers and you put them in a cage, they don't want to eat each other, but it's like the strongest have to survive, and that's what goes on.
Yeah.
You know, people are starving so bad that the fact that I have friends that will kill another friend because the friend has more than them, and it feel like you're either waving it in my face. You know, like when you like waving like that commercial, it's like, you got to be quicker than that. It's like that type of thing. And then, or feel like if you have more than me, you're actually taking food out of my mouth, which is just, You know, it's a lot of that going on. And also, just to touch on Freddie Gray, he had lead paint poisoning. I don't know if y'all are familiar with lead paint. My brother also had it. So Baltimore was one of those cities where it was a lot of the houses were lead paint based, and it even seeped into like the ground and into the water. So growing up in high school, we wasn't even allowed to drink the fountain water because of the levels of lead paint. And so you had a lot of my generation, you know, kids in the 80s. You know, a lot of my peers were like crack babies because of the crack epidemic. Then you look at lead paint, which breathing it in or drinking it, it causes brain damage. So you're talking about that causes you to be bipolar. You might end up being schizophrenic. You might, you know, have all these different behavioral issues. And then instead of getting these kids help, what they do is they just cut them a check. They say, all right, well, your lead paint level was this high. You're worth $100,000. But this thing about it is once you take that to court, then it's hard for you to get a job because, you know, jobs not don't want to hire you knowing that you have lead paint and you're going to be, they feel like you're going to be an issue. So you look at people like Freddie Gray, you know, who are like two-time offenders who've been in jail, who are in the street life, you know, that's a lot of times they don't choose that. The streets choose them because there's no other way, you know. So, and then when you look, that's like how he grew up, you know. Right. So a lot of the work, you know, like this is actually Gilmore Homes, you know, kids running down the street. This is literally like a quarter over from Freddie Gray's block, you know. So it's a certain sense of community that a lot of people really don't see. They just see the struggle and they don't really see the beauty in it. Yeah, we do ride horses through the hood too in the city.
Philly and Baltimore.
Yeah, you know, and these a lot of, you know, we're on Pennsylvania Avenue. You know, Baltimore has a lot of culture that people don't talk about. If you think about Pennsylvania Avenue, you got to talk about Billie Holiday. You got to talk about the Spence Club. You got to talk about, you know, Red Fox, who had a club on Pennsylvania Avenue on this iconic strip where the uprising took place. You know, you fast forward now and you look where we are. You know, the city is like standing on its last legs. So then you start getting into the death of Freddie Gray. You know, I told you a little bit how he grew up. You start talking about police brutality, which is like so normal because the police are taught to get these quotas and do these things. And yeah, a majority of the police force is not even from Baltimore. So they watch The Wire and then they come to Baltimore and like, oh, is Baltimore just like The Wire? They have to be this way. You know, like even for me, I was, you know, it's been days that I can be walking down the street minding my business and police will hop out on me, you know, and just mess with me for no reason. You know, I've had police officers put drugs on me just because they wanted to lock me up so bad. I had police officers like take my mom's car, you know, like stuff like that. You know, so like usually these police officers, they target people, you know, and they will continuously mess with you no matter what. So it's just like you live in this neighborhood, you can't go anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, and I never forget my friend Sean Gamble. I don't know if y'all ever heard of Sean Gamble. It was really big back in like 2011. And basically, he was in a nightclub with his friends and got into an altercation with an off-duty police officer because he was harassing this girl and he intervened. The off-duty police officer, they all got thrown out. The off-duty police officer pulled a gun out on my friend. The on-duty police officer just saw a man with a gun and started firing down the street. Murdered the police officer and murdered my friend. You know, the police officers got off and so on. So it's like so common. We're so used to it. Like my mom raised me on how to avoid the police. If a police hop behind me, I know I even need to make an immediate right or I need to pull over and put my cautions on like I'm about to get out the car. It's been times police get behind me, I would just pull over, hop out, and then wait for them to go. And then I get back in my car. You know, it's scary. So when you think about the Freddie Gray situation, the issue with Freddie Gray is like he was like the last drop of water that made that pot overflow.
Yeah.
You know, he was the last drop. You know, this is generational pain that released. You know, and then the history of Pennsylvania Avenue, you know, you got to think about back in the 60s when everything was going on. It was the same block. It was the same strip, you know, Pennsylvania Avenue where they're standing up right here. You know, so, you know, it was just generational, you know, and then Freddie Gray was just kind of that thing that we all felt like he was one of us. It easily could have been me or any one of my peers.
Yeah.
You know, so a lot of us just was like, we don't know what we're doing, but we have to do something, you know, and then me being an artist, I just use my art form to document it.
Yeah, and, you know, when we were coming in, I was just having some casual conversation with Devin before we got started. I said, you know, I'm born and raised in D.C., so is my uncle. And so the parallel between Pennsylvania Avenue and Baltimore being this strip of culture and life. And Pennsylvania Avenue in D.C., of course, is known for 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue and the White House, although I lived off of Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast, which was very much like you described. Yeah. And so this idea of shared experience becomes really important when we talk about what my uncle tried to capture and what you have captured, and sharing it through media that is relevant to the time.
Right.
So for my Uncle Maurice, that was the Washington Afro, that was Ebony, that was Jet, and other places that would invest in being able to publish these images and tell the story. And I think it's really significant because, as many of us know and probably learned in school, for Dr. King, as a leader of the civil rights movement, he understood the power of imagery in taking the story away from the marches and the immediacy of what was happening and broadcasting it out to the world so that people could understand the treachery that was going on in our communities, mm-hmm. the injustice and what have you. And so you were used to using Instagram yeah. as a medium just to share.
Yeah.
What was that moment when you realized that that particular image of the young man running down the street and the police line that was behind him, when that really went viral?
Right. It was crazy because I didn't know the image was really that good until it actually got on Time. The Time is not one of my favorites. You know, it's a good image, but you know, when I wasn't really thinking, you know, it's funny, like I was just talking to Aaron, like, you know, all this stuff, these pieces here, this is one of my first time shooting a protest was for a friend about this work that we're looking at now about Palestine. And it's like, I'm a kid from Baltimore. My friend is from Palestine. He said, I love your work. You know, he's dating a friend of mine. Can you do it? I was like, I don't know anything about protest. And I was like, where's Palestine? You know, and he was like, he gave me the whole spiel. And I was like, all right. You know, and that's when I kind of understood. And then around the same time, Mike Brown died. Yeah. You know, and I would try to send my work to the local media outlets, but I couldn't even get a reply or email back, you know. And yeah. I was like, my work must suck. You know, I was going to quit. I was like, it must be really bad, you know, because no one is replying. So, you know, at this point, you know, I just was like, you know, I'm going to keep going. So when Freddie Gray died, I start traveling, like catching a mega bus to New York. And I would like write my name on prints and give them out for free in New York, like in Brooklyn and stuff, to get my name out there. So yeah. People was like, who's this guy? And they would follow me. So I was able to get like 10,000 followers on Instagram, like 5,000 followers on Twitter. This is like 2015. So when Freddie Gray died, I just grabbed my camera and I just went out, you know. And then the thing is, on my camera, I had Wi-Fi. So the goal was to move faster than media and be steps ahead, you know, because most journalists have to run back to their laptops. I can stand in the mix of everything and just post. And the difference between me and other journalists, this is my community. So when I'm posting this stuff, 9 times out of 10, I got a homeboy that's back to back with me. You know, or I got someone that'll grab me if it feel like I'm in danger. You know, we moving as a unit because I know everybody, most of the people that I'm marching with, because they my peers. A lot of these people I grew up with, and we're on the ground together because my homeboy, I'm marching with him. He's Freddie Gray's friend. He's leading the march, you know, so it's like, all right, cool. You know, I knew where everything was. So on the day, we were very peaceful for the most part, but the day, it was a Saturday. A lot of people don't notice. I got called a liar on panels, but it's like photography don't lie because I have the actual, you know. And I remember we went out. It was beautiful. I've never seen, you know, so many people in the projects that wasn't from the projects. It was just beautiful. We had people from all over.
Right.
Different ethnicities and races and, you know, religious background. It was just beautiful, you know, to get that support, you know, to have that support for a black man, you know, and it's rare, you know.
Yeah.
And so we marched from Gilmore Homes all the way downtown, you know, and it was an Orioles game going on, our baseball team, and usually the police that escort us, it was no police. They were all stationed down at Camden Yards at our baseball stadium because they didn't want us to mess up the game. So we went to City Hall, and the younger generation was like, we need to go. That's where all the police are at. We need to go confront them. So we marched down there. I'm documenting everything. And as I'm documenting, I'm just like shooting, uploading, you know. And I've been doing it for like the past like 3 or 4 days, mm-hmm. When I decided to like dedicate my Instagram fam. And then I remember we made our way around. It was drunk Orioles, and I believe they were playing the Yankees, drunk fans. And we were just, you know, traffic was being blocked because we were protesting, you know. You know, people had I Can't Breathe shirts, hands up, don't shoot. People had hoods on, all different types of things, you know, because it wasn't just so much about Freddie Gray, it was just about the state of you know, what's going on in the United States in general for black people, you know, which was beautiful. And I'll never forget, like, a peanut came from, like, the direction, like, hit this guy. Next thing you know, they was, like, throwing food at us and laughing and calling us monkeys, the N-word. Like, they was calling people with, you know, other people that was marching, like, oh, you marching with them? You nigga lover? Like, it was just, like, this 2015. So now you got to deal with the fact that, like, even for myself, growing up in Baltimore, it's a lot of redlining, the way they run traffic and run communities. So certain streets only take you to certain parts of the city. So for me, I didn't interact with, you know, anyone outside of the black community until I was like almost like 19 years old, you know, because of the way the city is set up. You know, you have Jewtown, and then you have, you know, everybody just split up, you know. And so now you're dealing with, you know, kids that are like 16, 17, protesting, being called this for the first time, coming from white lips. And it's like, what? So they ran up to it was a gate between them. I will never forget. They met them. I have a shot of this lady, like, antagonizing, like, what you going to do? What you going to do? And they still throwing stuff at the kids, and then they broke out in a fight. And that's how it actually started. And then that rage was unleashed, and they started trying to flip the police cars up. Over, and I'm just shooting. So as they start turning the police car, I grab my homeboy and say, keep your hand on my shoulder, because it's like glass flying everywhere. So I'm like, keep your hand on my shoulder so I know it's, you know, I'm good, you know. So I'm shooting. I know there's no hand there. I'm like, where he go? And next thing I know, he go right here trying to help flip the police car over. I'm like, you supposed to be watching my back. Like, what are you doing? He's like, my bad, I just got caught in the moment. I was like, whatever. So we kept shooting, and I watched this guy run past. I don't know, he throws something. And I just run into position. I run away from the police cars. It's like all the, like, seasoned journalists got their helmets on and everything on the police cars. And he just run, and I just manually focus, and I just wait for the moment, then snap it. And then I'm like, this is a dope picture. And I'm, like, trying to upload, and the police are, like, right here. And I just, like, hopped over the fence. Like, CNN actually found footage of me hopping over the fence and, like, using it when they interviewed me, which was really cool. But
yeah.
I didn't know anything about it. I posted it. My mom was in the house watching my daughter, and she called me. She said, her's getting crazy on that. Be safe. Get home soon. Your daughter ate a whole bunch of sugar. She got into the candy. She's hyped. Come get her. I said, all right, Mom, I'm on my way. You know, I was lying. I was not on my way. So she called me again, and she said, where you at? I said, I'm walking to the car. I told you we marched from Gilmore Homes. So I got to walk to the car. I'm still down here. She was like, you sure you going to your car? And I was like, yeah. She was like, at the time I had a big afro, and she was like, I see you right here on CNN in between. And I was like, right between shooting. She was like, you better get home, you know. And then I remember going home and, you know, finished watching it on TV. And when I went to sleep, I remember while I was still down there, before I left, I posted the image saying, we're sick and tired. And when I went to sleep the next day, I woke up and I had 20,000 followers, and the BBC DM'd me and wanted to interview me.
Yeah. Yeah, as well as should be. There's a gap that my uncle's photos and your photos don't necessarily articulate, but is part of the reason why we selected the images that are selected for the permanent installation. Because even though my uncle's appointment to the White House News Photographers Association and his tenure at Johnson Publications was very much characterized by the, you know, opening of the civil rights movement and then into our country's political transition. Mm-hmm. A lot of my uncle's images were not of protest emotion. They were capturing the significant people and trying to convey a sense of dignity, which of course is one of the main reasons why Ebony Magazine existed, period, was to show portraits of black culture that we weren't getting, to show humanity, to show prosperity, yes, in some senses, that we belonged in America, that we belonged to part of American society, that this was a moment for us all to consider, why would you relegate people to a lower station in society just because of the color of their skin? Mm-hmm. which is an extension of the idea of equal rights and justice and marching and all of the violence that took place as a part of those protests. And so, you know, there may be a disconnection that I'm hoping our installation and the study guide that we're preparing and the educators in the audience to talk about the juxtaposition of Uncle Maurice's images and Devin's images, because Devin's images are protest and people in the moment as they live, not necessarily done up and posed, which is what you know, my uncle tended to capture, particularly for the pages of those magazines. Everybody who saw Jet magazine is familiar with the Jet beauties. So we know that was a different appeal, right? That we wanted to show beauty. We wanted to show this idea of belonging. And this is a different sense of people fighting to belong and be heard. And so I know that, you know, you were deeply moved by Gordon Parks, and then that escalated, and you had a mentor that wanted to give you more education on sort of the arc of black photography. Yes. So talk about how that's influenced your choice of portraits.
For me, like I said, I didn't know much about photography, so I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know how powerful it was, and I didn't know it had been done before. You know, like when you see, like, they teach this in school briefly. You know, most of the knowledge that I obtain is from my mom and my grandmother. Mm-hmm. You know, they teach us briefly. They never really talk about the people behind the cameras and who's documenting what, you know, and the importance of, you know, inspiring and knowing those things. So all I knew was Gordon Parks, you know, and I saw his work with the gangs in Harlem and Muhammad Ali. This amazing portraits of Muhammad Ali that was sold me that. I was like, this guy's amazing. You know, his Vogue work and how he was able to direct and, you know, compose and do all these different things, which really inspired me, how he moved in all these different realms and could do journalism and documentary and then translate that lens to high fashion and, you know, and then still come in and do portraiture, you know. So my biggest thing is, I feel like your uncle's a perfect example. I feel like every artist is important to reflect what's going on around you in the times that you live in. And then I feel like at the same time, we're obligated to use our art, definitely as black artists, to tell these stories. So for me, after I was, you know, I was capturing all this work during, you know, the protests and everything, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. I just was trying to digest what was going on and then regurgitate to the rest of the world. And I wanted, my biggest thing was, how can I control this narrative? You know, because I get sick and tired of how people talk about Baltimore, and they talk about us like, you know, even when the mayor spoke out, or you think about Obama called us thugs, they called us all types of things. And it's like, how can I can show you the passion? How can I tell the truth, you know, and still find a way to not sympathize, but enrage you? You know, like, people call me a documentary photographer. I look to create a conversation that needs to be had with the work that I create, you know. So that's what I wanted to do. And I just didn't know, like, how to move. And then it's crazy how the universe works. And, you know, I feel like I'm blessed, and I have, like, a divine, like, my ancestors just, like, look, keep going, here you go, keep going. You know, so around this time, I'm completely lost on what to do with the work, you know. And I met an amazing guy by the name of Aaron Brown that works at the Smithsonian. And the biggest thing is, I stress to our artists, is knowing what came before you. It makes you better. And he gave me all these books. I was telling her in the back, like, because I didn't know. He told me about your uncle. He told me about, you know, Tony Barboza. He told me about, you know, Deborah Willis and all these other great, you know, photographers that came before me that was already doing the work and in different space. And in turn, now I understood what I was doing, you know. And I will never forget Robert Houston. He came to my show, and he gave me a print and then tucked this note in my back pocket. Say, I'll see you later. And then the paper said, it's your turn now. Continue to tell our story. You know, I just feel like I'm just continuing what was always there. And your uncle was reflecting what was going on at the time, you know, and now I'm reflecting what's going on as we transition in Baltimore.
Yeah. One of the other things that is very parallel between most of my uncle's work and yours is that both of you chose to shoot primarily in black and white. And I know that there was there's a conscientiousness in my uncle's work in the civil rights movement era in particular about shooting in black and white, because that was the national conversation. That was how we were trying to build bridges, get true allies, and a good reverend friend of mine said there's a difference between allies and accomplices. Allies will stand next to you. Accomplices will get arrested with you and be like, how are we going to get out of this mess? You know, that there's a deeper sense of belonging, and we're in this together when you have an accomplice. And so I wonder, you know, especially you being a relatively young brother, working in a digital medium,
yes.
Yet so much of your early work was shot in black and white. What was the conscious decision for you?
I just feel like it might just be me, but I feel like how the human brain works. I feel like when we look at an image, we got to digest the colors. So if I drain the colors, it makes you focus, you know, on the emotion of the image. And I actually learned how to shoot black and white by playing with film cameras. Because when I bought a digital, I bought a Canon AE-1, and I just would play with film. And it helped me hone my skills on, you know, how to pick shots, how to, you know, be on time. You know, yeah. I feel like in the digital world, we let the machine drive, and we get real lazy. We just hold down that shutter and just hope. Oh, we got it. Did we get it? Nope. Oh, we did. Oh, okay. You know, but whereas though, when I do my work from shooting with film and just playing around, you know, I'm very strategic. I learned how. It's kind of weird. I'm a people reader. I can predict what a person is about to do. So if I'm out, and I learned that from doing street photography. Because I did want to do portraiture and shoot. Like, I shot models here and there, but it was hard to shoot because nobody wanted to come in the hood. They're like, Baltimore, oh, no. That was like the place over at, you ever seen Lion King? And they was like, don't go over there. And Mufasa told them, don't go over there. That, you know, definitely, like, people from, like, PG County and D.C.,
man.
You know, the new gentrified D.C.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
We can't come to Baltimore. That's like a third world country. So it was hard to get, like, people that I wanted to shoot with. So I was just like, I'm going to just use my community as my models. So I learned how to, like, you know, take my time, you know, drain everything out, what's going on around me, and then focus on my subject.
Yeah.
So, like, when I'm shooting stuff like this, like, it's a lot going on, but I'm only focusing on one thing. I'm watching his foot go up and down and waiting for a moment, you know, and then taking my time. You know, and I shoot in black and white, you know, because I want to get all my tones right. And then I need to get the shot right so I can get out to the world faster.
Yeah.
So I actually shot all these on a little Fuji in black and white, and then I Wi-Fi them to my phone. They still on my phone. Shout out to the iCloud. and then I just send them out.
Yeah.
You know, and I just think it's all about timing.
So this is the image that was on the Time cover, for those of you who haven't seen it or haven't seen it up close. So it just gives you a feeling for this idea of how quickly things escalate, and yes, how important it is to shoot the moment.
Yeah, and everything is, like, if you look at and pay attention to my imagery, I'm real big on my lines. Camera's always straight. I'm real big on vantage points. You know, timing, once again. I felt like the image was, I had enough time to decide who I wanted to focus on. So I felt it was stronger to focus on the police to give it, like, that fit, and, like, he's, like, really running. If I was focused on him, they would have been more blurry. It wouldn't have been as powerful, you know.
Yeah.
So this was supposed to be in Time magazine too, until they noticed the middle finger from the kid on the bike. You know, so, like, I like to tell the work is, like, black and white is raw, and it tells a story, and I want to keep it all cohesive and together. And you talk about allies, that's, like, I mean, that's my accomplice, one of my accomplices. We became good friends after I took this image of her. The sign is actually in the Smithsonian now. We've actually she's been arrested. She's stopped me from getting arrested, you know, a couple times from getting too close to police officers. You know, like, we're a community in Baltimore. So as I photograph these people, they become my peers, my friends. You know, we all fight together, you know. You know, and I love this, one of my favorite images. You
and
know,
it's in the back. you can see it up close.
We're on Pennsylvania Avenue, but you just see, like, you know, a biracial family. You know, and I think that's, like, well, I think that's American. You can't get more American than that, you know. You know, people cleaning up the community, which we did, you know, after everything. You know, so black and white is still my favorite. I'm back shooting it now. I only shot color because people say I was one-dimensional and I only can shoot one thing and I only can shoot one way. So when people tell me I can't, similar to your uncle, because people say I couldn't be a photographer, I had to go to school. And then people say, oh, he only can shoot black and white. He only can shoot this. So I was like, all
right. Right.
Watch me work, you know.
So the other thing that I think is important to mention in that particular context is that, you know, you and my uncle both had the means to go get the equipment, and then you spend time doing what you love, and you may not have all of the formal terms that people would learn in art school or what have you, but you have the principles because you're doing it every day. Mm-hmm. And you're getting to know your own style, your preferred subject matter, how you want to share your gifts with the world. And you have made it a very intentional point to begin to pass down this knowledge, hard-earned knowledge, to the next generation. So talk a little bit about deciding to continue moving from working photographer to instructor. And we're talking about little people. We're not just talking about teenagers, college age folks. We're talking about little folks.
Yeah, I think it's important, you know, for me, when I started, when I was on the ground, it was coming to an end. Like, you saw a lot of images. There's a lot of kids on the ground with me. You know, like, it's like, I don't know if there's more images. That's another series at work.
I was going to say, well, you could use the back arrow if there's another image that you wanted to get to.
Yeah, I was just trying to get back to, all right, cool, there we go. Like, you look, it's like a lot of kids on the ground. Like, this is the National Guard. This kid is like, he don't understand, like, I won't go across the street. They're like, in his neighborhood, they're like, no, you can't. He's like, the corner store is right there. He's like, you got to go around. They made him walk all the way down the alley, come all the way around, you know. And it's like, I wonder if he had a camera, what would he capture, you know. And if I was able to do all this work, you know, it got to the point where I was able to control the visual, like, it got to the point where everybody else started shooting black and white. And then people thought everything coming out of Baltimore was mine. They calling me. I'm like, this is not mine. This is somebody else's. I don't know who it is. You know, I'll try to figure out who it was. You know, but it got to the point where BBC was on my, contacting me. You know, ABC, MSN, everybody, you know, Huffington Post, CNN. They had photographers there, but they, Davin, where you at? What's going on now? It got to the point where I'm one person. What if I had, like, just these kids who are from the community that actually started the uprising. These kids started that. It wasn't adults. It wasn't. These kids started that. You know, kids from the ages of 10 to 16, mm-hmm. 17, they started the uprising, you know, and I wonder if they had the photography with it, you know, how more powerful we could have controlled the entire narrative. So right after, it wasn't even that long. I'm going to say it was probably like the uprising for us. It didn't really never really end for us because it feel like we're still in it because a lot of us deal with, like, I came out of it with depression, more post-traumatic stress, anxiety is real bad. You know, a lot of us were suicidal. So for a lot of us, you know, like, I got hospitalized for trying to commit suicide through going through all this. So, like, for us, the uprising never really ended. So a lot of us were stuck. So, like, the way that I was starting to heal myself was, like, how can I pass this knowledge on, you know? And so I remember just starting to go from me, like, in June. And I was like, I'm going to teach kids photography. And mind you, I've only been doing photography for like 2.5 years. I don't know. I only know the basics. You know, I know how to put the lens on. I know my aperture, my ISO. You know, I know the basics. And I started a GoFundMe. I've raised like $3,000 in a week. Even the guy from GoFundMe reached out. The creator of GoFundMe was like, I saw your work. I'm a fan. Here's $1,000. You know, I was like, all right, cool. Thank you. And then I don't know if you're familiar with DeRay. He wears like the blue vest all the time. He reached out to me. He's originally from Baltimore too. So when everything like was happening, we like got connected. So he called me and we having a conversation about where we're going with Baltimore. You know, like all the stuff that was going on. Like Baltimore was a mess. You literally had the police commissioner fussing with our mayor on Twitter, like Twitter beefing, like on Twitter talking about, I didn't say send police. He's like, yes, you did say send police. I'm like, y'all grown and y'all supposed to be our leaders here. Why are y'all fussing on Twitter? You know, and it's a mess. And we had like a 2-hour conversation. He was like, oh, I forgot why I called you. Russell Simmons and Michael Skolnick is looking for you. Then I'm like, so we sat on the phone for 2 hours. And you didn't tell me these people were looking for me. I'm like, what do they want? He was like, I don't know. I think they got to have some money for you or something. I'm like, okay, what's the number? You know, like, I'm like, all right. He's like, he kept trying to have a conversation. I'm like, I'm going to call them, and I'm going to call you back. So I called. He didn't answer. Then he finally called back. He's like, this is Devin Allen. He's like, I'm a big fan. I love your work. I saw you got GoFundMe. Tell me about it. And I just told him, I was like, I was on the ground with these amazing kids, and some of these kids were getting tear gas with me, pepper spray with me. And I was probably, my life was changed from it. I only can imagine if I had like 10 kids with me that I already had taught what we could have done, you know, and we could have covered way more, you know, we would have been way more powerful as a unit than just me. And he said, I love that. How much you need? And I'm like, I'm like, hey, Ma, how much should I ask for? She was like, it's Russell Simmons. He's just going to write it off anyway. So I was just like, I need $20,000. He's like, I'm going to send you $25,000. I was like, he's lying. So a couple of weeks go past, maybe a month, and he was like, I need you to just write something up for the book. So me and my mom sit down, write it up. And he's like, all right, well, the check here, you know, and I got like a little Scion hatchback. So I go to pick the check up from the Reggie Ralph Lewis Museum, me and my daughter. And they didn't give me the real check yet. They gave me the real big one. So I stuffed the check in the car, and I'm just riding up Pennsylvania Avenue to go show my grandmother. So all I hear is, as I come up the block, let me hold something. Let me hold a dollar. Like, it was crazy. Like, the whole community just was flipping out. And I remember I just bought some cameras, and I went back to Freddie Gray's neighborhood. I pulled up in the trunk, popped my trunk. I had like 15 cameras. Samsung sent some cameras too. And I was like, I just popped up like, who wanna learn photography? And they looked at me like, and I'm like, I'm going to Asia to shoot Steph Curry in a couple of weeks. They was like, for real? Teach me. And so since then, I've just been, you know, I've taught Studio Museum of Harlem. I donated to their film photography program. Mm-hmm. I just came back from Oakland. I ran a Steph Curry funded a youth program in Oakland where I taught street photography. I've given out almost 350, close to 400 cameras so far. So some kids I can't work with, but I was like, here's a camera, shoot me a DM. You know, I try to make myself, easy to find, I'm accessible to the community. So like, you know, if I meet a kid, you know, I talk at a school and the kid's into photography, you know, I'm gonna buy you a camera. It's just that simple. So if I have funding or not, I've traded in my own equipment, I've given equipment away. You know, the thing is with photography, after watching Through a Lens Darkly, I never forget like just how propaganda really affected and how the world looks at the black community based off of the way we were projected to the rest of the world using photography. You know, they use photography to make us look animalistic. You know, that's where like the idea of the black brute, how they would photograph us and make us look brutal. And, you know, and that's how the rest of the world looks at us a lot to this day in certain spaces. Like, I never forget like going to parts of Asia and getting looked at crazy, you know, and I want to change that, you know. So I think the more photographers we have in the world, the better we can control the narrative, and we can't leave the media, you know, to tell our narrative. That's why I tell people all the time, you can post your bad food pics and your ugly selfies, but Instagram and Twitter and Facebook are very, very powerful. You know, it's a way to connect you to the rest of the world, and it's a weapon. Yeah. You know, photography, going pops, that's his weapon. Photography is my weapon. Writing is a weapon. And now we have a platform when we don't need these other media, you know, platforms. And that's why a lot of them are shutting down. And they're trying to convert. And they try to use Instagram influencers. And they try to, you know, it's getting to the point where we control the narrative as the people, you know.
Yeah, as it should be. Yeah. And your story, and what I hope is being impressed upon all of you here, is this idea of rules and how sometimes we lose out on grooming genius because we're so tied to the rules. I have had more than my share of conversations with people who are in education administration who refuse to yield the rules as they've been set up for how you are credentialed to teach in particular to people who have followed the rules and gotten certain degrees but are so far removed from the everyday of the subject that they're handicapped in terms of what kind of passion, not just the following the rules to get a score on a test, but to actually understand the material, particularly for our children who already feel alienated in a lot of these educational spaces. And let's face it, if we're talking about neighborhood public schools in Philly, we're also talking about environments that are not conducive to learning. They're dangerous. They are full of these other environmental concerns, like you've mentioned, lead in the fountain water, all these other things going on that are distracting them from the process. And so the director of music education in Philly schools is a good buddy of mine who I met at the open mic scene as Philly was really blooming in that respect. He's a saxophone player. In order to teach music in Philly public schools, you have to have a music degree or music education degree. You have to have taken your praxis exam. So you have to be certified in order to teach music. And I don't know how often you all go to concerts or just hang out in the cultural scene here in Philly. Some of the most brilliant musicians in the world come from Philly, not through music education programs, but through the church and through mentorship by older musicians who recognize the talent and want to groom it. None of those people, for the most part, I mean, maybe 1-2% of them, have the credentials to teach music in our schools. Yet, administration doesn't see how ridiculous that is. Change the rules to get the talent in the room where you can impact the children and give them real education. This is a problem. And so programs like yours, a passion like yours, is essential in our society for what we know our children are not going to get in public school and in a lot of times not on the university level either. Because these people aren't in the street seeing and feeling and developing their style the way you have. And so this passion has now morphed for you into several other things. So talk to us a little bit about curatorial access and commercial commercial hires.
Yes. My biggest thing is like I'm a conduit for my community. So when I move or any type of thing I do in my career, I always think about where I come from, who I'm moving for, who is it hurting or who is it helping, who am I alienating or who am I inspiring. So the thing is sometimes I have to do things that I don't want to do because I know it's important to the community. So my biggest thing is like I need to break down doors so that any other kids coming from where I come from want to pursue this. Like you said, they might can't get into the institutions like MICA or these other big art institutes, but they can just grind it and still get to these spaces. Mm-hmm. So for on a commercial side, when I first got this, I had to remove, my thing is my art, like I do sell prints and stuff now because it is my artwork, I am an artist, but my work, I removed like my job and then my passion. I had to split the two down the middle because I don't want to have to like go against my moral compass,
right?
You know, so like I can't be a photojournalist because I found that out when I went to Salzburg, Austria, and snuck into a Syrian refugee camp because I was just so intrigued what was going on, and I went to go photograph these families. And it's not that I couldn't get a clear picture because I could, I'm good, but I couldn't spend enough time with them, and I really couldn't tell their story because I couldn't really digest it because I haven't gone through it or I'm not that tied to it. So instead, sometimes, you know, you gotta put the camera down, and I always tell people that some of the best photographers know when to put that camera down and actually live in that moment.
Yeah.
So I put the camera down. I just played soccer with the kids. I took a couple portraits and then, you know, just played with the kids. And I was like, well, journalism is not for me because I have a big heart and I don't want to like. You know, I like to control the narrative of my images. So Under Armour reached out to me, and being out of company in Baltimore, you know, powerhouse, you know, so for them to reach out to like a kid from West Baltimore to shoot an athlete like Steph Curry and buy my passport and take me to Asia and all through Asia, you know, it kind of woke me up. And it was like, I realized how powerful I am. And it was like, all right, if I can shoot with this and I can kill this job, they're going to be looking for other photographers in my community.
Yes.
So I was like, all right, cool, I'm gonna do it, you know, and I did it. It was amazing. They loved the work. I was able to come back and freelance some more. At the same time, you know, I'm still on the ground, and I expressed that to them. Like, look, I'm on the ground. That's not going to change. And eventually, I ended up getting a full-time job there. So I'm a staff photographer for Under Armour, and I shoot athletes. You know, I just shot a campaign for the LGBT community. But now I've because of my level of success outside of the business, I've able to have I have a certain level of respect inside the company.
Yeah.
So where, you know, I just shot the LGBT community, I forced them to use my peers, my friends from the LGBT community in the shoot, which usually they would just get athletes to do it.
Yeah.
Or they would hire models, you know, so it's just like, understand how powerful I am, and now I'm able to like creative direct and do these things and get respected for it. But then on the flip side, still being able to get other photographers and people coming up in the art scene opportunities with Under Armour. You know, and because they are based in Baltimore, you know, so on the commercial side, I'm still able to move and also influence that space.
Yeah.
Because it's a me here brand. It's all sports. It's like it's a hyper masculine space. But since I've been there, they've outreached to the community more. You know, like fixing up schools, and you know, they've been doing that, but they're doing a little bit more using local models now, using local athletes, using more local kids inside of shoots. You know, and that's the power of art, and then, you know, them respecting the vision.
Yes.
You know, and then outside my personal work, everything that I do, you know, the uprising is over. You know, like I'm still on the ground in Baltimore. I teach a lot. But then also I moved into a space where I do a lot of speaking engagements for, like, you know, the Gordon Parks Foundation on behalf of them. I just spoke at the National Gallery of Art. And then I'm real big on mentors. You know, I feel like a lot of people don't see how vital they are in the growth. A lot of people have like that, I'm gonna get it on my own, I'm gonna pull myself up by my own bootstraps, and I ain't had no help. The reason why I'm so successful, because I know it takes a village. And everything that I have done and been able to do in every platform as I grow is because somebody from higher up has extended a hand, and I've taken that. You know, Swiss Beats, him and our friendship took me to another level. Hank Willis put me in shows and photographed me for campaigns, you know, and then just getting those opportunities and then doing good work, you know, and then puts me in positions to give back even more, because if I get, the bigger I get, you know, every time I come back to Baltimore, I live in the city and everything. When kids see me, they be about to faint. Like, it's weird, it's super funny, but it's like, as I grow in every move that I make, you know, it's expanding my career is vital. You know, and now I'm moving into other mediums where photography is always going to be my first love, but a lot of the work that I can't always convey it just with a photograph. So my more recent work is trying to understand the landscape of Baltimore. You know, like, I'm very good at showing you the people, you know, and but now I hate to do it, but it's just like when you think about it, when you're studying an animal, or to understand that animal, you have to look at that habitat. So now if I can give you a certain sense of compassion of what happened and the people of Baltimore, now let me teach you about the landscape and why and what we look at every single day and understand Baltimore and the plight that is going on. So what I did was I started studying surrealism, because I love where surrealism came from. It came from the struggle.
Yes.
You know, and it's similar to me. All the stuff Picasso and all those Salvador Dali, what they were creating, you know, and I was going through the same thing with the uprising and the things that were going on in Baltimore, and I started studying it. So I wanted a lot of people come into my community, and so many other communities like Detroit, Philly, Baltimore, and they photograph vacant homes, but they don't understand the story of them and how deep it is and how rooted it is. So from studying surrealism and looking at how they paint things and how they move objects around, like Salvador Dali painting the clocks in weird positions and stuff, I start looking for inanimate objects that ties to the human experience to give these spaces a more human feel, to understand that the energy that's left behind. So, you know, like growing up in the hood, we all played on milk cartons. You know, the flowers spewing from the vacant home, or left behind, you know, artifacts, as I call them, you know, or, you know, Baltimore, every time someone gets shot, people spray paint no shoot zone, you know, from where someone was murdered, you know, like just diving into these vacant homes and trying to, you know, make you look deeper into these things, you know, as these places are disappearing. And, you know, family portraits that are left behind. You got to think about how hard it is to leave your family portraits behind. So the goal of this and what I did was, it was like, how can I take my work further impaired with other things. So what I did with this show was, it's called I'm Always Last Minute. Like, when I first met Aaron, he was there when I came up with the name A Beautiful Ghetto. Like, I'm an artist that I go with the flow.
Yeah.
I don't force anything. I reflect what's around me. And I met Aaron, and this guy, Mitch Dunier, was working on a book called 500 Years of the Ghetto. He ended up taking me to Italy, and we had dinner in Baltimore, because when Mitch reached out to me, he was like, he wants you to come to Princeton. And I was like, he wants to meet me. He has to come to Baltimore. And they came. And he asked me to describe Baltimore, and I was like, it's beautiful, but it's the hood. I'm like, it's the ghetto, but it's beautiful to me. And he was like, say that again. I was like, it's a beautiful ghetto. He was like, I love it. It's provocative. You need to do a show. And then I did a show here, and then I got a book deal. And then so with this show, I didn't know what to call it. I'm not good at naming my work. So I was sitting with my mentor, Jeffrey Kent, who's an amazing painter in Baltimore. He hangs with like Amy Sherwood and everybody. And he mentors me and been teaching me about art and painting and stuff like that. And we were sitting over coffee trying to come up with a name for the show. And he was like, well, what is it? I'm like, it's just spaces. And he's like, but you got a name. I was like, I don't know. It's like, I'm like, I all my work is untitled. And he was like, but what is it? And I'm like, I don't know. I was like, for me, it's like a spaces where the word post-Trump election, everybody talks about, a big word I hear a lot is entitlement, and self-entitlement. I'm like, but we always talk about people being entitled, but nobody talk about people that's not entitled. He was like, so what are you saying? I'm like, I want to hear something. I was like, I don't know. I was like, I can't title my work unentitled. He was like, no, say it again. He's like, say it in one thing. And I was like, I don't know. It's spaces of the unentitled. And he was like, that's the name of the show. And I was like, all right, cool. Spaces of the unentitled. So it's looking at the landscape of Baltimore as it changes and it's being gentrified and people are being forced out. So what I did was, instead of just pairing it, just putting up photography, me and Jeffrey actually went back to to these places, and we actually took things that were left behind. We built the installation with real objects from people. So I had report cards from like 1950, family portraits, objects, clothing, TVs, all different type of things that were left behind, and we built it out. So when people came in, it was an interactive space. And then I paired it with a performance art piece. Like I said earlier, I lost a lot of friends to gun violence. And a lot of my friends, I haven't said their names in years, because of the trauma that's with it. So what I did was, from studying, performance art and a lot of performance artists, and it was this one artist, came up with her name, you might know it. I think she was Russian. And she did this performance piece. She had people cut her hair. Mm-hmm. And she, Marina Abramović. Yeah, so I was looking at her, and I was like, she's amazing. And this stuff is new to me. So it's like, when I be at these art things, and they be like, you didn't know about her? And I'm like, okay, I didn't go to art school, I'm sorry. And so I did this performance art piece where I built a podium around the rubble, and I would stand up, and I would start recollecting like the last conversations that I had with my friends and talk about those moments. Then I got up on a podium and I called out, many names I can remember, so it would be around 20 names, but every time I would say a name, a paintball gun would shoot me in my chest, and then I would have no patent on, I just had a hoodie on. So, and I paired it with that, and then, just pushing the ball and then going into different mediums.
Yeah.
The more I do, the more the kids get inspired and people with the community feel like, if Devin can do it, because I'm so accessible, that you can see me ride my bike through the community, you be seeing me taking pictures on the corner, like the community knows me, so it's like, the bigger I get, the more they inspire and they can reach out to touch me, and they can feel my energy, and they get inspired.
And people talk a lot about this idea of finding your purpose. And I don't know, for people who are still struggling to wrap their arms around their own, I think they think it's this moment of epiphany and then all of a sudden everything else, it works out, which is not how this happens. And hearing you talk about your journey, learning as you go and incorporating more knowledge into the way that you do things, I'm reminded of, now I am far from a professional photographer, and I realize that part of my gift is being a collector of stories. And so I went to New Orleans I was reached out to by an independent artist that those of you who are old enough to remember when there was such a thing that they called acid jazz before it turned into what people call neo-soul, an artist named Jaleesa Anderson. And she had heard some of my music and just heard about my work in Philly. And she was like, what are you doing for Jazz Fest? And I was like, first of all, I'm glad you're on my phone. and this is crazy. I was like, don't have any immediate plans. And she's like, before Katrina, she was doing a residency in the French Quarter, preparing to do a tribute to Nina Simone. And so for the first Jazz Fest after the storm, they asked her to come and share kind of her reimagining of some of Nina Simone's work. And she was like, I would love it if you would come shoot it. Well, sure, I'll do that. And volunteer for an organization that was then called Hands On New Orleans, doing rehab. And they were dedicated for 2 weeks before, the 2 weeks of, and 2 weeks after Jazz Fest to help rehab the homes of elderly musicians from the city to try and help them come back, to continue to restore the cultural legacy of the city. And so, I go down very idealistic, very wide-eyed with my camera, and almost everyone that I asked, could I sit and basically interview them about their thing, they said, no, but I'll talk to you. And so, camera was nice, but it wasn't the purpose of being in that space. I had a lot of amazing, heart-wrenching, but triumphant conversations with people who had been through the unimaginable and were determined, come hella high water, because FEMA was not it. And pardon the language, I have to tell you all, the hardest laugh I had when I was down there for that was a t-shirt on Canal Street, hanging in a tea shop window, and it said, FEMA's evacuation plan is run, motherfuckers, run. But these are people who legitimately, any way they could, boats, prayer, floating on doors, they got out, but as soon as they could, they came back to try and clean up those houses, make them habitable again, and be a part of the city. And so for cities like ours, Philly and Baltimore, where we have seen this intentional displacement of natives, people who are in their haste to get out because we don't know what conditions made them leave in the first place, leave this behind, the tragedy and the stories behind this. This image in and of itself is a story, but there's so much more folded into the idea of what happens when you look down and you realize that pages of your family album aren't there. And so I'm going to wrap up our part of this conversation and then open up the floor for our audience to ask questions. When you picture, because I don't know if you could have envisioned what this journey has been for you, thus far. When you picture other things that you might want to do, other places you might want to go, or projects that are, I hate to say bucket list, because we shouldn't have to check up, measure things by when we leave the earth.
Right.
Just things we want to get done. So in your life to-do list, what other things are you building toward in this moment?
I want to be one of the greatest artists of my generation. I do want to be the modern day Gordon Parks, literally. So I want to direct films, I want to do documentaries. I'm going to do it all. I'm studying painting right now and other mediums. I don't want to leave no stone unturned. And then the ultimate goal, before I leave here, is to have a gallery in Baltimore for the youth, ran by the youth, and that's what I want to do, a gallery in the city that can give back to the community. That's the ultimate goal.
Yeah.
And have my daughter run it when I'm two.
Has she picked up a camera yet?
Yeah, my daughter is very wise beyond our years, and she shot her first protest at 7 years old because she nagged me. I want to go with you, Dad. And I was like, all right, come on. It was just a simple protest. It wasn't nothing too crazy. Police officers took this guy's arm and pinned it up so far behind his back that it shattered his shoulder, and then they made him walk to the police station. And then refused the medical attention, so it got affected in the jail. So we went to document that together. She's more of the dancer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's a dancer. So,
yeah.
So that's the goal, just to open up as many doors as I can, and yeah, like have a gallery and possibly even have a school in Baltimore one day.
Yeah, and promote justice.
Yeah.
The thing, the injustice that we rarely get a chance to see up close and personal, and getting us all to at least think about what real justice looks like. These are words that we use so casually, so often, and that's why, you know, I can just speak on behalf of the family in terms of Maurice Sorrell's work, but to have Maurice Sorrell's work side by side with Devin Allen's work in this space here at SLOT that is dedicated to get us all to think more critically about what social justice really means and how we participate. Everybody's not going to be a photographer. Everybody's not going to be the person up front in the protest with the bullhorn, but we all have a role to play in defining what social justice means for our individual communities and collectively, and how we get there. And so we hope that you will spend some time looking at the images and allowing them into your spirit to influence you in some way, and to also come back and make use of the space. One of the things that's great about the installation is it's in a space that is designated for community use, for organizing, for having access to do research. Well, we want to give those of you in the audience that may have, and you know, I'm here for window dressing, really. You know, Devin is the focus of tonight's conversation. So if you have a question that you'd like to ask him, please.
How long did it take you to see yourself officially as a photographer? Because I've been doing like photography. I'm also from Baltimore, by the way, born and raised. But I'm struggling with like seeing myself as like a photographer. It's just like something I can't wrap my head around.
I really don't care about titles. Mm-hmm. You know, like whatever you're doing, if you're taking pictures, everyone plays a photographer at least once. I would just worry about creating, not even worrying about the titles. Yeah. You know, I actually hate when people call me a photographer because I can do so much more. But I don't worry about like titles. Like me, I just like to be called an artist because some days I might want to take pictures. That's my main medium. But some days I might want to write poetry. Some days I might want to paint. You know, I wouldn't get too hung up on or waste any time just worrying about that. I would just worry about just keep creating, keep taking those pictures. I wouldn't even worry about the titles because you really won't know. You'll know when it's dead. Oh, I am a photographer. You know, like it's not based off of the level of success. It's not based off how much money you make, because I know photographers that are, you know, make a lot of money, but they suck. It's just they're not good, you know, but they're still a photographer.
Yeah.
You know, but you can't base it off like how much money you make or how many pictures you take a day or anything. You know, but I wouldn't even worry about the title. I would just like just keep creating. That's what about, and then like whatever people want to call you, like let them call you, but you know what you are, you know what you can do.
Have other people around you called you a photographer?
I mean, my family supports me, and you know, like I have friends around me that are like artists, but they're like the painters, they're like the performers, and I have those interests, but for me, I do like the documentary style, and I've had that vision, but it's me getting over like the fear of like, especially street photography. I don't like being in public, you know, just photographing people, and people are like, why are you taking a picture of me?
Right.
I don't, you know, so.
I've run into the issue. Some days I'd be ready to go. Some days I don't. Some days I might need a couple shots to get the flow going before I start taking pictures. But the biggest thing is like, fear can be like your worst enemy. It'll stop you from doing so much. Like you had to put that to the side. Like what's the most that can happen? You know, like if I was too scared to do these things, I wouldn't be sitting up here. And then it's not the fact, like it's good to know that you're scared, because sometimes people don't know that they're scared. You know, and they might don't know like, oh, this is anxiety kicking in. You know, my biggest thing is identifying that fear and then, you know, embrace it. And then if street photography, you might love it, but it might not even be your thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I want to shoot certain things, and like I love like landscape photography, but it's not my thing, but I still do it. You know, so like I would just, you know, embrace that fear, and that fear can actually help you hone in and find out what actually it is that you can actually create. You know, like me, I use fear to create. No, so.
Yeah. Have you ever seen the film Biker Boys?
No, but I'll probably look it up tonight.
Okay, so the only reason I mention it, and you're going to think it's crazy, because it's about street clubs and biker clubs.
Was Tyrese?
Yeah.
Tyrese,
he had a bit part, though. It was more Lawrence Fishburne and Derek Luke. But anyway, So the head street racer, when he prepared for the race, he literally got tunnel vision. Mm-hmm. That, you know, on the bike, prepared to zoom down the street, it's almost like he could tune everything else out and all he could see was the finish line. Mm-hmm. And I think for a lot of people, when you're in that zone of this thing that you love or this thing that speaks to your heart, mm-hmm. sensations like that come upon you. And so, you know, so give yourself an opportunity to dig in and see the things that make you feel like that.
Yeah,
and also, you know, don't worry about the title.
You got different techniques too. Like, maybe shoot with a smaller camera that people won't pay attention to. You know, like for me, a lot of my shots, like, I shoot from the hip. Like, people don't know I'm taking pictures of them. You learn different techniques.
Yeah.
Or you do something where you might be aiming over here the whole time. You might have a certain lens. I might can look like I'm taking pictures as well, but I'm really taking pictures of her. You know, you build those techniques.
Yeah.
You know, like, so for street photography, for me, is like, I don't like ruining moments. So I either shoot with, like, you know, I get small cameras, or mm-hmm. I shoot from the hip, or I have certain techniques where I can trick people and make them think that I'm not taking a picture of them. You know, so I would just play around with it, find your path.
I loved what you said about feeling as though the people that you're taking pictures of become your peers. Would you say that any of the police, for example, that you've taken pictures of, that you've kind of like felt shared humanity with them, or that they've reflected on the pictures that you've taken and seen a kind of shared humanity that they didn't see prior to viewing the images that you took?
Yeah, it's actually an image in here, I believe. Did I go past it? There you go. Mm-hmm. All right, like this guy right here. You know, it's funny because like, it's not so much that I never really hated police. I hate the system that they uphold and they protect, you know, kinda. And so it's funny because like I'm on the ground, probably one of the only few like a lot of us was getting like harassed. A lot of us, like some of us had our phone taps. Police would follow us after everything was going on. I had friends who had their cars, tires slashed so they couldn't get to the protest. It's like an activist named Tyrone West, who, his sister protests every single Wednesday since the death of her brother. And she had to keep buying tires because the police would keep like slashing them. So she wouldn't protest. It's a mess, but I have made friends through some, you know, like community policing. You know, those that I know care, you know, that's actually on the ground, that, you know, go against the grain, but they still a part of the system at the end of the day, you know. But like this guy, I never forget, this guy and like some other police officers came to the show because it was his picture. He wanted to take a picture with his son. But I know one of his friends that is a police officer because I went to, with the high school, I don't even know they was together, but they knew each other because they were, of course, on the police force. But he was there, but I knew him before he was a police officer.
Right.
And I had another homeboy. We all from like the same neighborhood or whatever, but he's a little bit older. So him and my homeboy, who was like, he's a drug dealer, like he's in the streets, they were having a conversation about the whole uprising, right? So I'm just sitting back and I'm just listening. And this is when I really realized how powerful my work is. I'm just sitting in the Reginald F. Lewis Museum at my first show, just listening. And they talking. They, neither one of them know they're on the opposite side of the fence. And they're like agreeing on so many things. And I just slayed in and it was like, hey, y'all know each other? And I was like, no, you're a police officer, right? I'm not gonna tell them what you do. And they just like looked so stupid. You know, and they continue the conversation. You know, that's when I realized I was a dialogue creator and I'm able to create conversation and bring people together. You know, so I was probably one of the only activists, and probably still am, that gets respect from all sides. You know, and it's needed. You know, because I can play the middle ground between some of these conversations. You know, but
I would also encourage you for a Philadelphia perspective on that of police getting a different sense of shared humanity. This was several years ago. Back when Otis Hackney, who is the city's current director of public education, was principal at South Philadelphia High, they were having constant race riots among students at the school. And the police would come in to intervene and were not helping the situation. So a number of different community groups got together, and during what they called the alternative school time, so like night school, at South Philly, they would bring students in and the cops that were interested in participating for dialogue sessions so that everybody could get their feelings out about what they were seeing happen around the campus, and then they brought in photography. So they restaged editorial images that had run in the Inquirer and Daily News of the violence. They restaged those photos with the students and the cops, and then got a chance to talk about what that position, what those facial expressions, what all of that meant. I wish I could remember what the initiative was called, but the archive of it, the blog that they created from that project, should still be available online.
Hey, Steph.
Hi,
how you
Chris.
Doing? Devin, I really appreciate your work. I was so happy to be one of the people who got the poster when did your joint here the first time.
Yeah.
And I placed it, I was working in a school, so I placed it in the library at the time. So shout out to being there a couple years ago. But I do want to ask, so following you on social media and seeing your relationship, I had a chance to talk with Dee Watkins recently. And seeing this sort of like new Baltimore wave of artists, writers, creatives who are putting work out into the world. And I think Steph, you like the our best black work has always come out of like these collectives.
Yeah.
And folks who are sharpening, like iron sharpens iron, and that like relationship between a communities. They don't have to be doing the same art, but they're involved in like, we see ourselves as responsible for a narrative. And I want to like ask you about like that work, or that like critical accountability work of like how you all are involved in sort of like shaping in some ways, or like how Baltimore is seen in this moment, or what stories are shared from Baltimore, how you bring new voices and people on in that moment. And then like that sort of like practice of like, how do you hold one another accountable? How do you sort of like share a vision of what you all are saying, and how to like, I don't know, it might be like a real just like social thing, you know what I'm saying? It's just like those conversations, but.
Yeah, I think I try to align myself with just real people. Like, you gotta be real to be around me, you know, and authentic, you know, and I have a certain level, like Dee Watkins is like a brother to me. You know, like, he wrote the foreword to my book, his photo was in the show. The thing is, we all came out of this thing. I knew Dee Watkins before the uprising, but we got closer post-uprising. The biggest thing is like to stay inspired and to get better, you have to hang with other creatives. And you have, my mom always said this weird thing to me, like, only hang with people that are evenly yoked. And I'm like, what the hell does that mean? You know, and like, I understand it now. Like, you ever try to cut a yoke straight down the middle? You can't cut it down the middle. You know, so if y'all equally yoked, it's like tight, you know. And so I try to run with people that inspire me, that I know have a good heart and look to actually change Baltimore. The thing is, like, with Dee Watkins, we come from, Dee Watkins is from an older generation than me, but Dee Watkins just had bullets removed from his leg, but he didn't let that stop him. You know, he ended up being a professor at Cobb, professor at John Hopkins, you know, New York Times bestseller, got his own show on Salon, you know, helped write some stuff for like Jada Pinkett's movie, like really working, you know, which really inspires me to keep working even harder. You know, and the thing is, we our vision for Baltimore is like, we really feel like it's like a renaissance. Like, you know, one of my boys is like James Baldwin, of course, I'm going Parks, and, you know, Dee Watkins is like, you know, Langston Hughes, and, you know, like, we all like coming up together, and we're like the new wave. When you really look at all the creatives, time really repeats itself, because we're literally doing the same thing that our predecessors did from the civil rights and so forth ever, you know, since. And it's just a beautiful thing to be aligned and know that you're not alone, you know, when you're trying to, you know, fight this bigger narrative and trying to, like, actually change these things. And then we're more powerful together and more impactful because, like you said, it's certain how the school system is set up. You know, we understand who we can touch and who we can't reach. So sometimes I know that Dee Watkins can touch certain kids that I can't touch, and he knows certain kids that he can't touch that I can touch. And that's why when we collaborate and we move as a unit, and we all hit up the same schools, we donate books to the same schools,
right.
We pull up, we do all our we do panels together, you know, because we have to like stick together, you know, like to really push that narrative. You know, like we're getting so powerful that you can't even like deny us. Like, you know, I've realized how powerful it was when some of the mayors were running around and like was calling us to get on their campaigns, you know, or like when like Hillary Clinton reached out to Instagram for me to shoot like the DNC or something, and like all this stuff, you know. And that's when I realized how powerful we are. Like, our art is very powerful. It really can shape things. So like, as when I move, I always look closely who I'm connected to, you know, also for legacy purposes. You know, like, I don't even want to run around with the wrong people. And, you know, like, imagine how everybody feel running around with Bill Cosby. They probably feel crazy right now. You know, like, you really think about it. You had to run around, you know. I try to, people that have the same moral compass, same goals, the same values. And I like to be around people that selfless. You know, that they can make these moves. We're going to make our money so we can survive. But we're not going to, like, take up too much space. You know, because me and D-Watt is always looking for, or, you know, D-Watt is, helps, works with my homeboy Kwan Donnie. I don't know if you know about him, amazing poet. You know, yeah, he gonna get mad if he hear this, I always mess his name up. But, you know, D-Watt is runs with him, or like I have my little mentees or like little homeboys that's trying to come up in the art that we pick up and we bring along, you know, because we're trying to build a conglomerate, trying to build a, because we only going to get so big in Baltimore, we're going to have to travel more and more to see the rest of the world so we can evolve. We can't leave the home front empty. You know, like when we move to New York and then to study or do these art residencies and all this stuff, we got to make sure that Baltimore is still taken care of and is still moving, you know, on a foundation that we want to lay.